Da Vinci Code, Introduction and Major Questions by Robert C. Newman. What's the buzz? The Da Vinci Code is an awful that has attracted an enormous amount of attention. It's a murder mystery of the thriller sort. It contains 454 pages, but divided up into 105 short chapters. A real page-turner. Yet it claims to be a sort of historical novel, that it's historically accurate, with fictional plot and main characters. Consider the claim it makes. Here's the complete text of page 1 of the Da Vinci Code. Fact: the Priory of Zion, a European secret society founded in 1099, is a real organization. In 1975, Paris's Bibliothèque Nationale discovered parchments known as Les Dossiers Secrets, identifying numerous members of the Priory of Zion, including Sir Isaac Newton, Botticelli, Victor Hugo, and Leonardo da Vinci. The Vatican prelature known as Opus Dei is a deeply devout Catholic sect that has been a topic of recent controversy due to reports of brainwashing, coercion, and a dangerous practice known as corporal mortification. Opus Dei has just completed construction of a $47 million national headquarters at 243 Lexington Avenue in New York City. All descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. So, the Priory of Zion, a European secret society founded in 1099, is a real organization. All descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. Are they? Well, we will see. The book has sold extremely well. It was published in April 2003 and was an immediate bestseller, sold 40 million copies in paperback, and was still on the New York Times bestseller list as of June 2006. A movie based on the book was released in May 2006 and did well, though did not receive good reviews. The book is exciting and well-written, as this sort of book goes. The book is highly controversial. Here's a secular cartoon illustrating the controversy of it. The cartoon Zippy the Pinhead, written by Bill Griffith. Griffey, says Zippy, the sort of inner child of Bill. Does the sun circle the earth? Nope, other way around. Does the moon emit its own light? Nope, reflects the sun's. Then I've based my whole faith on several falsehoods. That's the way the dogma crumbles, Zippy. But without nutty beliefs, the sales of many best-selling books would plummet. Really bad writing alone cannot explain the success of the Da Vinci Code. The popularity of the book is not totally about its attraction as a mystery thriller. Much of the interest is surely about its claim that traditional Christianity is a hoax. So, let's have a look at the plot of the Da Vinci Code. First, the murder. The victim is Jacques Saunier, curator of the Louvre, and secretly the Grand Master of the Priory of Zion. The murderer is Silas, a large albino monk connected with Opus Dei. The master plotter is the teacher. Mysterious, unseen, he provides information to Silas. The hero and heroine, Robert Langdon, professor of religious symbology at Harvard, in Paris to give a lecture when the murder occurs. Sophie Neveu, cryptographer for the French judicial police, sort of the French version of the FBI, granddaughter of the murder victim. The plot. The story begins with a murder about 11 p.m. inside the Louvre. Langdon is awakened at his hotel an hour and a half later by a phone call from the police. He's summoned to meet with Bezu Foch, crack investigator of the judicial police, at the scene of the crime. Foch secretly suspects Langdon, as Langdon's name was in Saunier's calendar to meet with Saunier earlier that evening. The murder scene. Saunier has been found dead, naked, and lying in a pose that matches that of Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. In the few minutes between being shot and dying, he managed to leave several cryptic clues about what is going on. The plot thickens. As the police prepare to arrest Langdon, Sophie manages to spirit him away. They decipher clues her grandfather has left behind. These involve a secret group guarding a devastating secret about the church. The plot moves on. The rest of the book is a combination of their flight from the French police and from Silas the murderer, while simultaneously seeking to locate and decipher the clue Saunier has left behind to direct them to the Grail. In the course of their flight, Sophie and Langdon travel to several places in France, then to London, and finally to Scotland. Sir Lee Teabing. They seek out Lee Teabing, ex-British royal historian, who lives in a chateau outside Paris. Teabing is one of the world's experts on the Holy Grail and the Priory of Zion. Teabing fills them in on the Grail secret. Now we look at a few pages out of the book. Page 230. Seated on the divan beside Langdon, Sophie drank her tea and ate a scone, feeling the welcome effects of caffeine and food. Sir Lee Teabing was beaming as he awkwardly paced before the open fire, his leg braces clicking on the stone hearth. "The Holy Grail," Teabing said, his voice sermonic. "Most people ask me only where it is. I fear that is a question I may never answer." He turned and looked directly at Sophie. "However, the far more relevant question is this. What is the Holy Grail?" Sophie sensed a rising air of academic anticipation, now in both of her male companions. "To fully understand the Grail," Teabing continued, "we must first understand the Bible. How well do you know the New Testament?" Sophie shrugged. "Not at all, really. I was raised by a man who worshipped Leonardo da Vinci." Teabing looked both startled and pleased. "An enlightened soul. So, what is the Holy Grail?" Teabing looked both startled and pleased. "An enlightened soul. Superb. Then you must be aware that Leonardo was one of the keepers of the secret of the Holy Grail, and he hid clues in his art." "Robert told as much, yes." "And Da Vinci's views on the New Testament?" "I have no idea." Teabing's eyes turned mirthful as he motioned to the bookshelf across the room. "Robert, would you mind? On the bottom shelf is La Storia di Leonardo." Langdon went across the room, found a large art book, brought it back, setting it down on the table between them. Twisting the book to face Sophie, Teabing flipped open the heavy cover and pointed inside the rear cover to a series of quotations from Da Vinci's notebook on polemics and speculation, Teabing said, indicating one quote in particular. "I think you'll find this relevant to our discussion." Sophie read the words. "So, Leonardo da Vinci, one of the keepers of the secret of the Holy Grail. He hid clues in his art." The quotations. "Many have made a trade of delusions and false miracles, deceiving the stupid multitude." Leonardo. "And here's another," Teabing said, pointing to a different quote. "Blinding ignorance does mislead us. Oh, wretched mortals, open your eyes." Sophie felt a little chill. "Da Vinci is talking about the Bible?" Teabing nodded. "Leonardo's feelings about the Bible relate directly to the Holy Grail. In fact, Da Vinci painted the true Grail, which I will show you in momentarily. But first, we must speak of the Bible." Teabing smiled. "And everything you need to know about the Bible can be summed up by the great canon Dr. Martin Percy." Teabing cleared his throat and declared, "The Bible did not arrive by facts from heaven." "I beg your pardon?" "The Bible is a product of man, my dear, not God. The Bible did not fall magically from the clouds. Man created it as a historical record of tumultuous times. It has evolved through countless translations, editions, and revisions. History has never had a definitive version of the book. The Bible is a product of man, not of God." "Okay," she answers. "Jesus Christ was a historical figure of staggering influence, perhaps the most enigmatic and inspirational leader the world has ever seen. As a prophesied Messiah, Jesus toppled kings, inspired millions, and founded new philosophies. As a descendant of the lines of King Solomon and King David, Jesus possessed a rightful claim to the throne of the King of the Jews. Understandably, his life is recorded by thousands of followers across the land." Teabing paused to sip his tea and then placed the cup back on the mantel. "More than 80 Gospels were considered for the New Testament, yet only a relative few were chosen for inclusion, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John among them." "Who chose which Gospels to include?" Sophie asked. "Aha!" Teabing burst in with enthusiasm. "The fundamental irony of Christianity. The Bible as we know it today was collated by the pagan Roman Emperor Constantine the Great." "But more than 80 Gospels were considered for the New Testament." I thought Constantine was a Christian, so he said. Hardly, Stephen scoffed. He was a lifelong pagan who was baptized on his deathbed, too weak to protest. In Constantine's day, Roman officials' religion was sun worship, the cult of Sol Invictus, or the invincible sun, and Constantine was its head priest. Unfortunately for him, a growing religious turmoil was gripping Rome. 3 centuries after the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, Christ's followers had multiplied exponentially. Christians and pagans began warring, and the conflict grew to such proportions as threatened to rend Rome too. Constantine decided something had to be done. In 325 AD, he decided to unify Rome under a single religion, Christianity. Sophie was surprised. Why would a pagan emperor choose Christianity as the official religion? Teeming chuckled. Constantine was a very good businessman. He could see that Christianity was on the rise and simply backed the winning horse. Historians still marvel at the brilliance with which Constantine converted the sun-worshipping pagans to Christianity. By fusing pagan symbols, dates, and rituals into growing Christian tradition, he created a hybrid religion that was acceptable to both parties. Transmogrification, Langdon said. The vestige of pagan religion and Christian symbology are undeniable. So, Constantine, a lifelong pagan, baptized on his deathbed, too weak to protest. Transmogrification, Langdon said. The vestiges of pagan religion and Christian symbology are undeniable. Egyptian sun disks became the halos of Catholic saints. Pictograms of Isis nursing her miraculously conceived son. Horus became the blueprint of our modern images of Virgin Mary nursing baby Jesus. And virtually all the elements of the Catholic ritual, the mitre, the altar, the doxology, the communion, the act of God-eating, were taken directly from earlier pagan mystery religions. Teeman groaned. Don't get a symbologist started on Christian icons. Nothing in Christianity is original. The pre-Christian god Mithras, called the Son of God and the Light of the World, was born on December 25, died and was buried in a rock tomb, and then resurrected in 3 days. By the way, December 25 is also the birthday of Osiris, Adonis, and Dionysius. The newborn Krishna was presented with gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Even Christianity's holy day was stolen from the pagans. What do you mean? Originally, Langdon said, Christianity honored the Jewish Sabbath Saturday, but Constantine shifted it to coincide. Nothing in Christianity's original. Shifted it to coincide with the pagans' veneration day of the sun. He paused, grinning. To this day, most churchgoers attend services on Sunday morning with no idea that they are there on account of the pagan sun god's weekly tribute, Sunday. Sophie's head was spinning. And all of this relates to the Grail? Indeed, Teeming said. Stay with me. During this fusion of religions, Constantine needed to strengthen the new Christian tradition, held a famous ecumenical gathering known as the Council of Nicaea. Sophie had heard of it only insofar as it's being the birthplace of the Nicene Creed. At this gathering, Teeming said, many aspects of Christianity were debated and voted upon. The date of Easter, the role of the bishops, the administration of sacraments, and of course, the divinity of Jesus. I don't follow. His divinity? My dear, Teeming declared, until that moment in history, Jesus was viewed by his followers as a mortal prophet, a great and powerful man, but a man nevertheless, a mortal, not the Son of God. Right, Teeming said. Jesus' establishment as Son of God was officially proposed and voted on by the Council of Nicaea. Hold on, you're saying that Jesus' divinity was the result of a vote? Jesus' establishment as Son of God was proposed and voted on by the Council of Nicaea. Hold on, you're saying Jesus' divinity was the result of a vote? A relatively close vote at that, Teeming added. Nevertheless, establishing Christ's divinity was critical to the further unification of the Roman Empire and the new Vatican power base. By officially endorsing Jesus as Son of God, Constantine turned Jesus into a deity who existed beyond the scope of the human world. An entity's power was unchallengeable. This not only precluded further pagan challenges to Christianity, but now the followers of Christ were able to redeem themselves only via the established sacred channel of the Roman Catholic Church. Sophie glanced at Langdon, and he gave her a soft nod of concurrence. It was all about power, Teeming continued. Christ as Messiah was critical to the functioning of the church and state. Many followers claimed that the early Christians literally stole Jesus from his ritual followers, hijacking his original message, shrouding in an impenetrable cloak of divinity, and using it to expand their own power. I've written several books on the topic. And I assume devout Christians send you hate mail on a daily basis? Relatively close vote on Jesus' divinity. Why would they? Teeming countered. The vast majority of educated Christians know the history of their faith. Jesus was indeed a great and powerful man. Constantine's underhanded political maneuvers don't diminish the majesty of Christ's life. what he's saying, Christ was a fraud, or denying that he walked the earth and inspired millions to better lives. All we are saying is that Constantine took advantage of Christ's substantial influence and importance, and in doing so he shaped the face of Christianity as we know it today. Sophie glanced at the art books before, eager to move on and see the Da Vinci painting of the Holy Grail. The twist is this, Teeving said, talking faster now, because Constantine upgraded Jesus' status almost 4 centuries after Jesus' death. Thousands of documents already existed chronicling his life as a mortal man. To rewrite the history books, Constantine knew he would need a bold stroke. From this sprang the most profound moment in Christian history. Teeving paused, eyeing Sophie. Constantine commissioned and financed a new Bible, which omitted those Gospels which spoke of Christ's human traits and embellished those Gospels which made him godlike. The earlier Gospels were outlawed, gathered up, and burned. Constantine commissioned a new Bible. An interesting note, Langton added, anyone who chose the forbidden Gospels over Constantine's version was deemed a heretic. The word heretic derives from that moment in history. The Latin word hereticus means choice. Those who chose the original history of Christ were the world's first heretics. Fortunately for historians, Teeving said, some of the Gospels that Constantine attempted to eradicate managed to survive. The Dead Sea Scrolls were found in the 1950s, hidden in a cave near Qumran in the Judean desert, and of course the Coptic Scrolls in 1945 at Nag Hammadi. In addition to telling the true Grail story, these documents speak of Christ's ministry in very human terms. Of course, the Vatican, in keeping with their tradition of misinformation, tried very hard to suppress the release of these scrolls. And why wouldn't they? The scrolls highlight glaring historical discrepancies and fabrications, clearly confirming that the modern Bible was compiled and edited by men who possessed a political agenda to promote the divinity of the man Jesus Christ and to use his influence to solidify their own power base. Some of the Gospels managed to survive the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Coptic Scrolls at Nag Hammadi. Well, we move on from those pages. Teeving goes on to explain how Leonardo da Vinci has hidden clues in his famous painting. He says the figure thought to be St. John is really Mary Magdalene, Jesus' wife and mother of his child, Sarah. The rest of the plot, we won't spoil the story by revealing how the book ends, but after Jesus' death, we're told, Mary Magdalene and Sarah were hidden away in France. The church covered this up, male leadership took over, and reconfigured Mary Magdalene as a prostitute, rejecting the sacred feminine. Well, that's the plot we've sketched for you of the Da Vinci Code. Questions raised by the Da Vinci Code. These include topics such as Christology, Scripture, Church History, various others such as Mary Magdalene, Leonardo da Vinci, the Templars, the Priory of Zion. Some of the questions about Jesus Christ. Who was Jesus? Was he merely a human? Was his status upgraded by Constantine? Was he raised from the dead after his crucifixion? Did Jesus really marry? Did he and Mary Magdalene have a child? Questions about Bible. Is our Bible very different from the one the early Christians had? Did Constantine prepare a new Bible? Did he destroy the Gospels which pictured a merely human Jesus? Did he modify the Gospels in our Bible to make Jesus look divine? What about the Gnostic Gospels? Questions about church history. What happened at the Council of Nicaea? Was Constantine a Christian? Did the Roman Catholic Church adopt many features from paganism? Has it been covering up a huge secret for nearly 2,000 years? Some miscellaneous questions. What do we know about Mary Magdalene? Did Leonardo da Vinci hide clues in his paintings that reveal the secret of the Holy Grail? What do we know about the Templars? What do we know about the Priory of Zion? Well, that's our introduction. Let's get started.